when Islamist militants released a video showing the killing of American journalist James Foley this week. They were sending a message warning the United States, which has been striking against them in Iraq. It was also part of their broader propaganda strategy, one that uses social media to directly reach their followers. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston has more.
The self-proclaimed Islamic State has spent much of this year honing an online media strategy with two goals. Their first, to intimidate religious and ideological enemies.
You're no longer fighting an insurgency. We are an Islamic army.
That's the militant fighter who executed James Foley, and he threatened President Obama and the U.S. directly.
So any attempt by you, Obama, to deny the Muslims their rights of living in safety under the Islamic Caliphate will result in the bloodshed of your people.
It seems to be of a piece with similar videos in the past.
That's Will McCants. He's in charge of the project on U.S. relations in the Islamic world at the Brookings Institution. And he says the Foley video followed a familiar intimidation script terrorists have used to great effect in the past.
With the orange jumpsuit, the man standing menacingly over him, and then the gory end. These are the same kind of videos you saw coming out of Iraq in the middle of the last decade.
Terrorists have historically used horrific acts of violence as a way to threaten adversaries. Now they're taking advantage of social media and rapid communications to get their message out faster than ever before.
Unfortunately, I think ISIS is one of the prototypes of 21st century media strategies and communications.
Bruce Hoffman runs a national security program at Georgetown University. He says that even the choices in the video show the group is considered how to tailor its message to a particular audience. One example, Hoffman says it's no accident that the executioner in the video speaks with a British accent.
That, you know, this is a familiar voice or a familiar accent transmitting this threat to us was just meant to, you know, heighten our sense of horror and unease.
Will McCants of Brookings agrees. The choice of an executioner with a British accent was a very calculated one.
It's to send a signal to the American people that, look, even your fellow English speakers despise you. And to scare the United States and the Obama administration that, hey, we've got Europeans here that don't need a visa to enter your country, and they are carrying out these horrific acts against your citizens. There's no reason we can't send them against you.
So that's the Islamic State's first goal, to intimidate. The second goal is something that sets the Islamic State media team apart from its predecessors. The group is trying to reach out to local Sunni Muslims and even to convince fighters to move their families into occupied areas. So that's why, McCants says, there are gentler videos, too.
The Islamic State produces a lot of videos that show them handing out dates and candy to kids, repairing electrical lines, taking care of sewage, that sort of thing.
And that message appears to be luring foreign fighters to Syria and Iraq, if not directly into the Islamic State's ranks. Those foreign fighters aren't just coming from the Gulf states. They also include Europeans and Americans. Intelligence officials tell NPR that the number of Americans going to Syria has more than doubled since January. They say between 140 and 150 Americans are now thought to have traveled there. The British contingent is thought to be about twice that number. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
President Obama's former campaign manager has gone to work for Uber, but don't expect to get him on your app. The ride-sharing startup service based in San Francisco has hired David Plouffe in the hope that the strategist who helped elect a president can steer Uber through a thicket of local regulatory disputes and set a course for future development. We're joined now from San Francisco by NPR's Aarti Shahani. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So why does Uber need one of the, obviously best and best paid political strategists in the country?
First off, they can afford him, right? Full time. I tried to find out exactly what Plouffe is getting paid. Uber won't say, but the company is valued at something like $18 billion. And in terms of why they need so much muscle, Uber is taking on the taxi industry for one. Cabbies are saying that Uber is just a smartphone-enabled taxi and should be subject to all the same rules they are. And that level of regulation would really hurt Uber's business. Then there's the whole part about insuring part-time drivers. Uber has a million-dollar insurance policy, but it's still very limited as to when it kicks in.
So what is David Plouffe's job on day one, would you guess?
While there are a lot of campaigns to be fought, Uber CEO Travis Kalanick is spinning this one as an epic campaign of Silicon Valley innovation against the big taxi cartel. Those are his words, not mine. Uber won't get into the details, but presumably Plouffe is going to lead a big marketing push. And the both of them appeared this week on Bloomberg TV to talk about the partnership.
Let's play a piece of that. This is Travis Kalanick talking about what David Plouffe's going to do.
You know, it's about communications, policy, branding, and strategy, and weaving that together to tell a story in the cities that we're going to about how safe the rides are, about the tens of thousands of jobs we're creating every month, and making sure cities understand the progress that Uber represents.
Tell a story. Now, that's become a very political phrase, like we have to establish a narrative for this campaign.
Oh, yeah, a very strong one. And mind you, Obama's 2008 campaign was a social media home run, and that was well before the app ecosystem and smartphones took off. And so, you know, you'll recall in Obama's campaign, there were homegrown sites and My Personal Obama Testimony. So now we might see a My Uber Stories take off with, you know, dads and moms talking about how they can pay the bills. So presumably bringing on Plouffe is in part an effort to push out the stories that show, hey, Uber is good for the public.
I doubt Uber's valued at $18 billion just because it wants to schlep people from point A to point B. They just started deliveries on demand in Washington, D.C., in fact. And a lot of people wonder if they're not trying to position themselves to be the next Amazon, deliver anything anywhere.
You know, Uber is experimenting with the transportation of people and goods and some very kitschy transportation, too. I mean, they did Valentine's Day roses and this weird get a kitten for an hour kind of thing. And it could be that they really expand their wings, their fleet, you know, not to mix metaphors, in the transportation of people and goods. It could be they go in another direction. They are backed by Google Ventures. They just made a huge partnership with AT&T, so they're clearly looking for partnerships and integration and penetration. And also, Google is about moonshots, right? So it's possible that they move beyond transportation itself into other kinds of goods and services. Now, besides Uber's business model, I'm really curious to see if Plouffe comes up with his own product line or startup. You know, he is a political operative who loves technology, and he used the internet to win the 2008 campaign for Obama. And frankly, right now, there's a bunch of tech startups that are making Get Out the Vote apps and marketing to candidates in both parties. So we might see Plouffe do his stint at Uber, milk all the amazing Silicon Valley contacts, and bounce to his own startup.
Aarti Shahani, NPR technology correspondent, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you wanted to find a video game featuring indigenous people that didn't include the usual stereotypes, it would be hard. But a group of Alaska natives has worked with a game developer to try to change that. The project is called Never Alone. From member station KTOO in Juneau, Heather Bryant reports.
In a high school in Barrow in far northern Alaska, students sit in a dark room. They're watching a demo of Never Alone, a game its creators hope will set a new standard in video game development. Like in movies, Native characters in video games tend towards stereotype, and few are heroes. But this game's different. It's based on a traditional story known as Kanuksayuka, and the experiences of Alaska elders, storytellers, and youth. The story follows a young Inupiaq girl and an Arctic fox as they go on an adventure to save her village from a blizzard that never ends. Game developer Sean Veshi has 20 years of experience in the industry working on action titles like Tomb Raider. He went to Barrow to watch the students play a demo of the game. He says that day was his most memorable experience from the project.
It was such a special moment because they were literally sitting forward, you know, yelling and screaming at the players to avoid the enemies and to navigate around obstacles.
Veshi's introduction to Alaska Native storytelling began 2 years earlier. It arrived in boxes of transcribed stories. He says they contain tales and creatures as interesting and imaginative as anything in the movies today.
We were just blown away at the richness, at the beauty, and the depth of that storytelling tradition, and we realized that none of that had really been ever explored in a video game.
Veshi made a dozen trips to Alaska with his team to gather more stories and imagery. Helping connect Veshi with the native stories was Amy Fredine, who is Inupiaq and the cultural ambassador between the developers and indigenous storytellers. She says that in native culture, everybody depends on each other, and that was the most important part of both the game's story and creating the game itself.
The last thing we wanted was to have this video game kind of be like a cultural appropriation. We didn't want this to be an outsider's view of what the Inupiaq culture was. We wanted it to come from the people themselves.
One connection Fredin made was with Jana Harcharik, who works in the Barrow School District to promote and preserve Inupiaq culture. Harcharik says when the students learned the developers wanted to hear from them, the kids began telling their own stories.
The ideas just started coming out. They were like, well, are you going to be able to maybe do this? Because I'm a whaler and I'm a hunter and I have this experience and it would be really cool if we could make this happen or that happen. There was a lot of excitement right from the start.
The whole idea for Never Alone came from the Cook Inlet Tribal Council in Anchorage. 2 years ago, President and CEO Gloria O'Neill asked developers if games could be used to share traditional stories. O'Neill says the Tribal Council was looking to invest its money in a way that would also benefit Native culture.
We started thinking about the future because our board also said to us is never forget who we are and where we come from, but think about how we can connect with our young people in the future.
Over time, O'Neill started to believe that the perfect way to do that is through video games, something people in even the most remote parts of Alaska want to play.
Not only we could make money with the right partners, but we had a medium in which we could share our culture with the world, that we could create this invitation of courageous learning with the world.
The video game Never Alone is slated for release later this year. For NPR News, I'm Heather Bryant in Juneau.
For years, scientists have been trying to replicate what octopus and squid do, change color to blend into their surroundings. Now researchers say that they've produced materials that can sense color and change accordingly. So does this mean that shirts will blend into your sofa or submarines can look like coral? John Rogers is a professor of engineering at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and he's one of the researchers who headed a team that's developed this camouflage technology. He joins us now from Evanston, Illinois. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Congratulations, and how does it work?
It's a multifunctional, multi-layered type of material that changes colors in a pattern that reflects the illumination that's incident on it, either from its front side or its back side.
So what have you done with it so far?
Well, we've demonstrated that you can actually put together all the pieces and make this kind of system in a thin, lightweight, flexible form. You know, the goal was really to take a deep look at how a cephalopod skin works. It's a spectacular, you know, engineered system that evolution has come up with, and try to sort of abstract some of the key concepts from the study of the biology and then implement them, you know, in a man-made system.
I gather this is a study for the Navy, right?
It's a study funded by the Navy. I think there are clear potential military implications of this kind of technology out into the future, but I think they're interested mostly, you know, at the basic scientific aspects of how one thinks about doing this sort of bio-inspired engineering.
I mean, we're being cheap and obvious when I mentioned, you know, maybe you could wear a shirt that blends into the sofa, but while we're on the subject, could you devise a shirt that blends into the sofa on which you're sitting?
Well, it turns out that there are folks out there who are interested in exactly that type of thing. So again, you know, my own motivation is more from an academic, basic scientific standpoint and blending, you know, biology concepts with engineering capabilities. But we have had conversations with faculty, for example, at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, who are interested in new technologies and how they could be used to advantage in, you know, enabling new concepts in fashion and design. And, you know, the other class of folks that, you know, have reached out and we've had discussions with are people in our School of Architecture. So you imagine interior design. You have thin sheets. You can put them on the walls or on different, you know, surfaces in an interior living space and make those adaptive to, you know, the ambient lighting conditions in an interesting way that, you know, opens up new possibilities in interior design as well.
John Rogers is a professor of engineering at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
If you're ready for some football, well, NFL season is just a couple of weekends away, and with it, the new version of Madden. Each year, the latest edition of the only official NFL video game tries to be more and more realistic, whether it's the commentary or the gameplay,
taking the snap out of the pistol,
or even the touchdown dances. But the game has never displayed players' real-life tattoos until now. NPR's Becky Sullivan explains.
Sumit Sarkar has been playing Madden for more than 20 years. Now he's a reporter for the gaming website Polygon. He says the franchise has made realistic visuals a huge priority.
NFL superstars definitely look like their real-life counterparts would. I mean, you'd be able to look at their face in the game and go, oh man, that's Eli Manning.
But tattoos have long been an exception. Some old versions had generic tattoos, Sarkar says, but no player has ever had their real ink appear in the game until now.
And here is quarterback Colin Kaepernick. And just now,
in real life, Colin Kaepernick, the young starting quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, is covered in tattoos. His chest, his back, his arms. In the newest Madden, the computerized Kaepernick sticks out like a sore thumb in the sea of bare arms along the line of scrimmage, because he is the only character in the game displaying his real-life tattoos. Tim Bradley is an intellectual property attorney. I asked him why some video game makers have been so cautious. He explained to me that copyright law is actually very friendly to tattoo artists. All they have to do to get the protection of the law is use a, quote, modicum of creativity in the design and put it on a, quote, tangible medium.
So that could be paper or film or what have you. And you automatically own the copyrights in that.
With tattoos, the medium is the person they've tattooed. But it's tricky. While the artists definitely own the copyright to their design,
the recipient certainly owns their body, so they own the copy of your work. And so the thorny question comes in about what happens when additional copies are made.
Meaning a recreation of the tattoo. Like, say, a video game version of it. Or more famously, this bit from the movie The Hangover Part 2.
Oh my God!
The guys have just woken up from their blackout night.
This is a real tattoo!
In a nod to Mike Tyson's role in the first Hangover movie, Ed Helms' uptight dentist character wakes up to find his own face now has a copy of Tyson's famous and distinctive facial tattoo. But the tattoo artist was never asked for permission for his work to appear on someone else's face. So he sued, and Warner Brothers settled. No surprise, the NFL Players Association started advising players to acquire the rights to their tattoos, especially players like Colin Kaepernick, whose real tattoos have become a signature part of his on-field persona.
And especially the one that, you know, the one when he makes that touchdown, he just goes for that bicep and kiss that, you know?
This is Nez Andrian. He's the artist who made the tattoos on Kaepernick's bicep. He runs a tattoo shop in Reno called Endless Ink. He says business has been booming since Kaepernick started doing all those bicep kisses on national TV. Andrian has gotten used to seeing his designs everywhere that Kaepernick and his famous body art appear. Newspapers, magazine covers. It was no surprise to see the tattoos star in a Yahoo fantasy football commercial.
Oh, hey, Colin Kaepernick here.
In the commercial, Kaepernick is shirtless, sitting in a tattoo parlor, surrounded by three tattoo artists working away with their needles. Nez Andrian's work on Kaepernick's chest and arms is on full display.
Wow, this says I'm the fantasy QB of the future. Let's write that in somewhere.
With lawsuits over tattoo use looming, it's no surprise that Kaepernick's agent got Andrian's permission before that commercial aired.
No, it's good for him. It's good for you, right? I'm like, yes and no, but he's not understanding my point of view. You know, like, I'm supposed to be in that commercial. You know what I mean? It's my work that they're showing, you know?
Nez Andrian told me he had mixed feelings about signing the waiver, and he says he hasn't received any money in return for signing. But he says working with Kaepernick has been a good thing for him overall. And once Kaepernick and his agents had the rights to the tattoos on his body, he was free to extend those to Madden. So if you're planning to pick up a copy of the newest Madden next week, try this out. Pick the 49ers as your team, send your quarterback in for a rushing touchdown, and watch as the computerized Kaepernick gives that signature bicep kiss to the Nez Andrian tattoo faithfully recreated on his digital arm. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Michael Brown's funeral is taking place this hour in St. Louis, Missouri. The unarmed 18-year-old was shot and killed by a police officer, sparking large protests. Beyond the bounds of traditional media, if you wish, you can watch this morning's services online through a live stream. Some say the crisis in Ferguson has been a turning point for live streaming news events in the United States, with millions of people watching the demonstrations there unfold in real time, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Jean Anderson, a first grade teacher living in a suburb of St. Paul, Minnesota, is a big Twitter user.
One night she clicked on a link from a friend to a live video stream coming from the streets of Ferguson.
The night that there was an absolute wall of police, and they were all wearing body armor, and they had clear plexiglass or whatever, shields in front of them, and they are slowly, slowly creeping down the street. Your heart starts pounding because this isn't a TV show. This is live.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
And then the tear gas canisters start going off, and they're getting hit with rubber bullets. I mean, the cameraman got hit. And I'm watching this live, and of course, there's nothing I can do about it.
There it goes there. Now firing onto the crowd. Out!
That was the voice of the cameraman, and here he is again.
My name is Mustafa Hussein. I'm the founder of ArgusRadio.com.
Argus Radio is a four-person volunteer internet radio station in St. Louis that had just purchased some equipment to live stream local bands when the protests broke out.
We were only getting bits and pieces from the major networks, and I knew we had this equipment, and I knew we had the ability to share what I could see firsthand since I happened to be right here in St. Louis.
The first night he streamed live, some 1.3 million people tuned in. Also among them was Jen Samford, a 30-year-old in Chicago, who found a link to the Argus stream on an internet page.
At that time, it was approaching the evening, and I actually was being able to see firsthand the police lining up the protesters here, and it was very shocking to me to see firsthand what was going on and to see what I didn't really feel like was being reported in some of the more major news outlets.
Because Samford was up until 2 a.m. some nights watching the live stream, she was able to catch nuanced exchanges among the protesters and police, the things that can't fit into a shorter story. Jean Anderson had a similar experience.
Then what I saw was, you know, these are human beings. These are teenagers and grandparents and little children that are walking and trying to make their voices be heard. And the fact that they come back night after night after night says that, yes, they're protesting the terrible tragedy, but there's a lot more behind it, or they wouldn't keep coming back.
Argus Radio was streaming its feed using the technology of a company called Livestream. Its CEO, Max Hout, says Argus set a record for a U.S. news event.
The audience and the rapid spread of the link and the speed at which the audience has built up is unprecedented.
Other people in Ferguson downloaded his app, too, and sent their own streams. The company's service has averaged 2 million viewers a night for streams from the events there. Hout says that kind of constant media attention also caught moments on tape that might otherwise have been missed, like the night that a St. Louis police officer pointed a rifle at Argus's Hussein and another journalist.
My hands are up, bro. My hands are up.
That footage found its way to YouTube and major media outlets. Eventually, the cop was suspended indefinitely.
So I think it really helps change the world in the way that people have a direct access with a breaking news event and can make their own judgment.
But even a live stream may not have caught the face of a police officer seeing a Molotov cocktail thrown at him. James McQuivy, an analyst at Forrester Research, says even a live stream can be deceptive.
Maybe there's someone who wants some attention who doesn't care about the issue who's going to show up. And maybe someone who cares about the issue but is more willing to use a devastating tactic, something violent or something obscene.
Live streaming has already taken off for some other types of events. Video gaming is among the most popular. There have been staged events like Red Bull's streaming of the highest skydive jump on record. Outside the U.S., another live streaming company, Ustream, says that some 50 million people watched the demonstrations in Kiev, Ukraine. James McQuivy thinks now that the technology is cheap and ubiquitous, we're likely to see more people stream major news events.
Nothing is as fulfilling as being right there and watching it happen. You know, the Civil War actually launched with people getting their carriages and going out to the battlefield and sitting on a hill and having a picnic while they watched the early battles.
Jean Anderson, the Minnesota first grade teacher, says it's been special to watch a stream from someone in a community.
Sometimes all you need to see a look on Mustafa Hussein's face, that says a lot. That at times he just looks so discouraged, at times bewildered that this is happening in his city.
But in the end, it's not clear if live streams will really help us get closer to the true facts around a major news event. Laura Seidel, NPR News.